arrival in the city. When you live from day to day, city streets don't have much pity. When you're down, that's where you'll stay. In the city. Oh, oh. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes saying, turn on the city lights for the man, the machine, the machine man. Of course, it's Corky McDonald, the Ubermensch. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, let me just drop a little Deus Ex Machina Man and drop on in, changing the whole course. Hi, Dan.
What's up?
It feels good to be here under these bright city lights of this big metropolis.
Especially since, you know, we grew up in the catacombs, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so to be here, you know, went from the bottom to the top, really, literally.
It's literally a Drake lyric come to life. Exactly. From the bottom to the top. Now we here.
Mm-hmm.
I was weaned in the catacombs, just a young little skeleton.
Yeah.
Hey, and, I was thinking, because catacombs play a big role in this movie, and they're not an invented thing. Like, that would be a thing you'd be like, okay, there's no way that's real. No, that's fucking real. What a weird thing to do.
Right? Just toss them down there and, yeah.
And wild not stuff. Just, I mean, that makes sense to me, just like out of sight, out of mind, like this fucking stinking, rotting corpse. But no, actually build things and make intricate infrastructure out of, yeah, your dead relatives.
Yeah. I tell you, these ancient civilizations, they're not like us.
No.
That's it. Now Kendrick Lamar lyric. I came full circle.
Oh, and yours is better. So, yeah, it's just like the real beef.
Corky, good to have you here. Good to be here. You
good
know?
To be had.
Good to be anywhere these days. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Corky, you know, it's award season as we're recording this. Maybe not when this is released, but it's award season for me anyway. So I'm getting all caught up on all these films. One thing I do want to call your attention to, which you may not have seen or heard about or know about, is a little movie called Nouvelle Vague by Richard Linklater.
No. He's little, making another one? Jesus, that guy's putting
no. Yeah, right? This dude's like Mr. T. Like, I need work. But yeah, I just reviewed Blue Moon for our show, for the website. Just a few weeks ago, and he's already got a new one, and it's on Netflix. Blue Moon was about Lorenz Hart, played by Ethan Hawke, and also Richard Rodgers as well. This one's actually about Godard and the making of Breathless. It's kind of a front to start, you know, here's how Breathless got made. But the reason that we haven't seen Breathless on our show, it's on the Sight and Sound Top 250, as is Contempt, the random number generators haven't thrown our way. But the reason I want to call your attention to it, it's a good movie. It's just a good, solid movie. And of course, it's Linklater, so it's like, it's a hangout movie, you know,
yeah.
At the same time that it's this like amazing recreation of like France in that era and of those filmmaking at that time. But it has connections to two films that we have reviewed on the show, and actually several other filmmakers who we've talked about on the show. So 400 Blows, one of the films that we've really loved on the show. The premiere of the film at Cannes is depicted in Nouvelle Vague. They go to visit Robert Bresson on the set of Pickpocket while they're shooting Breathless. So we get this whole recreation of Pickpocket as well, not to mention appearances by Agnes Varda, a vagabond fame. Jean-Pierre Melville of Army of Shadows fame has a part in Breathless. So it's really interesting for our purposes of just like all these touches of cannon fodder, you know, movies that we've reviewed or people that we've talked about on the show, because it is just all of these different, all of the people, all of the lights of the French New Wave get at least a line or a scene or a shot.
And I would love to learn more. Jean Sebring, she lived a pretty interesting life.
Yeah, she's played, interestingly enough, by Zoe Deutsch. Dare Daniel fame. What fucking was it? Was it Vampire?
Vampire Academy.
Vampire Academy, right?
Yes. Is that it?
Yeah.
Wow.
See, you really did not like her in Vampire Academy. I had her tapped for future stardom, and here she is playing Jean Seberg in Nouvelle Vague. But yeah, if you want to check out Nouvelle Vague, it had a little, very brief run in theaters. I actually played in 35 millimeter here at the Tower Theater in Sacramento for a week, I think. But now it's available to watch on Netflix. So if you're interested in that, I thought it was a solid film. One of those kind of Linklater-y, I like this, but it's something I probably won't remember.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. You know what else is award season? It's award season for all of our PayPal supporters, Dan.
Oh, boy. If I could give them all the awards.
We do give them all the awards.
Best makeup and hairstyling. Best makeup and hairstyling. Because they're so, so attractive.
I'm going to give every one of our PayPal supporters the I Fell For It Again award. Because you keep supporting us, and yet we're going to let you down inevitably. But we thank you and we love you. We couldn't do it without you. You're going to fall for it again.
God willing, yeah. Obviously, you're the heroes of our show, and if you'd like to donate, if you'd like to join their August ranks, go over to daredaniel.com. Find the menu at the top of the show, find support the show. You'll be redirected. You can support us in any way you want. One-time donation, monthly donation, yearly donation. Every decade, I think they do offer a century-by-century donation. Really, you know, the dollar goes further if you do it by century.
Right. Because you're paying.
It's like you think if you're donating ahead, think how much that donation would be in 100 years. You just donate it right now. I mean, that's just fiscal responsibility right there. Any contribution, though, will help keep this show going.
Tonight's movie we're discussing, Metropolis. The IMDb synopsis for Metropolis. In a futuristic city sharply divided between the working class and the city planners, the son of a city's mastermind falls in love with a working class prophet who predicts the coming of a savior to mediate all of their differences.
Yes, this week's film, it's Metropolis, the 1927 sci-fi silent film that is one of the classics of Weimar era German expressionism. German expressionism, like, one of the, if you're talking that bridge between silent and early sound film, it's probably the most influential of all of the kind of sub, you know, categories of art there. Its use of light and shadows was so groundbreaking, and Hitchcock was highly influenced by it. Of course, American filmmakers also highly influenced by it. And then Germans like Fritz Lang came over to America and started making films. And that was how they knew how to make films. This film, of course, directed by the great Fritz Lang, with a script by his then-wife, Thea von Harbo, based on her own 1925 novel. The novel actually started as a treatment for the film, went and made it into a novel, then made that into a script.
Hmm.
Cinematography by the legendary Carl Freund. Second oldest film we've reviewed on this show, Quirky, in our 52nd episode? It's also our fifth silent movie. Metropolis, best known for its audacious production design, envelope-pushing special effects, and post-World War I political commentary. But really, Lang was trying to compete with Hollywood. The Metropolis itself is partially inspired by American Art Deco skyscrapers, but the ambition of the project was inspired by the American studio system, by vertical integration, and by the kind of epic films that they were making, like Ben-Hur, the original Ben-Hur, Big Parade. So Lang said, you know, if we're ever going to compete with this, we got to go big too. And boy, big did they go. Metropolis started shooting in May 1925. The shoot lasted 17 months of shooting days, 310 shooting days, 60 shooting nights. The budget quadrupled over that time. And I think, Quirky, as we've seen with films like Jacques Tati's Playtime, when you take a big swing, spend a lot of money, and don't strike gold, it's a field day for the penny pinchers and the naysayers and the people who say, how dare you make art with our money. Visuals were praised, but the politics and the long running time were savaged. It premiered January 10, 1927, but the original 153-minute version was cut to pieces after the premiere and went missing for over 80 years. There's all these different cuts of the movie based on what country you were in, what the censors did in that country, and then other versions were cut and cut and cut and cut and recut. Various versions with soundtracks were created over the years. It was cut more when the Nazis came to power. And it actually was the Nazi 90-minute cut that was archived in the Museum of Modern Art that if you watch this film before 2010, that's the version or the basis of a version that you saw. In 1984, Giorgio Moroder, the composer, released a 90-minute, no, actually it was 83-minute version with a rock and roll soundtrack featuring Adam Ant, Bonnie Tyler, Freddie Mercury, Loverboy. At that point, the copyright had lapsed, and it was just the wild, wild west. Anyone who wanted to do any damn thing that they felt like with Metropolis could just like do it. The almost fully restored version, though, that we watched, I won't go through the whole history of how all these versions were cobbled together, because it's Byzantine, but that premiered in 2010, and it was created by merging a damaged print of the original found in Argentina with another version archived in New Zealand. It also restored the original Gottfried Huppert's score, which was only played once live at the 1927 premiere and never recorded until 2001. People doing things with the score of this movie is kind of one of the main things of just like just going hog wild with it. It's now tied for 67 on the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll, the best films ever made. Lang's 1931 film M, with Peter Lorre, placed higher at number 36, but his extensive work in Hollywood, including magnificent genre films like The Big Heat and Scarlet Street and You Only Live Once and Fury, they were ignored. The film's influence is immeasurable. Honestly, like truly. On sci-fi movies, most obviously, any film with any sort of futuristic urban dystopia almost definitely owes a direct or indirect debt to Metropolis. Blade Runner, really obviously. The design of C-3PO, very obviously, I think. Frankenstein, I mean, there's no doubt that James Whale saw this film before he made Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein. But also music, Bowie's Diamond Dogs, Madonna, Beyonce, the music video for Radio Gaga, Kraftwerk, they've all referenced Metropolis.
Fifth Element.
I mean, again, anything futuristic, anything yeah. like that. Yeah. But the question, I mean, Corky, did you go Gaga, Radio Gaga, over Metropolis, or are you criticizing Lang's Kraftwerk?
Dan, I got to say, I'm ready to take a Lang Day's Journey in tonight. That is a fucking fantastic movie that lives up to its legend. It is compelling as hell. A visual feast. The acting is really, really fucking good. Mm-hmm. And I will say that it's pretty amazing. This is, I think, our second film. No. Yeah, our second film in the last three where a young starlet has made their film debut at between like 18, 19 years old. And absolutely just gone for it and just crushed in a role that, you know, especially this one for the star of Metropolis. I don't know her name. Forgive me.
Brigitte Helm.
But iconic face, iconic portrayal, and remembered 100 years on. All those critics and penny pinchers, present company excluded, Dan, but critics, where are they now? What is it? Metropolis lives on, and they do not. So, eat shit, critics and penny pitchers.
Yeah, 25. I remember seeing this back in like the 80s or 90s on some very. I put this down as watching a new film because to me this was an absolutely new experience.
That's crazy. That is crazy.
Like what I saw before was fantastic, and I think people recognized even in that heavily bastardized version. What I'm seeing is amazing. Like, even if like story elements aren't tying together, even if like motivations don't make any sense now, like the character of Hell was removed. So like, why is this guy building this robot in the first place? Right. Like all these elements, like you could still see it was a classic, but now having it all almost all put together, man, you really get a feel for like what an epic piece of filmmaking this is. It's a visual masterpiece, absolute visual. I mean, your jaw just drops in the beginning at what they're doing here, but also it's a masterpiece of like ambition,
yeah,
and invention, and just going so fucking hard. The politics, they're very simple, I think, in a way, but they're complex in another way. But it kind of boils down to this repeated aphorism of the mediator between the head and the hands must be the heart. But even when the film is ridiculous, it's remarkable. That's what I think. And relevant as ever, bizarrely enough. Like, this movie is actually, they never explicitly say it, but in other kind of works around it or kind of research around it, people have pieced together that it's supposed to be 2026, which is the year, like it or not, that is looming upon, you know,
that's
looming
amazing.
Over us right now. And the movie is relevant. Like, it's highly relevant. Yeah, we're not building Art Deco skyscrapers so much anymore, but like this whole gulf between the idea of like the chasm between the wealthy and the poor. It's not just a divide, right? Like, the poor are so far on top, and the wealthy are so far on top, they're in towers over the city, and the poor actually live. They come up to work, and they go down to their homes. Like, that's such a dispiriting thing. The people coming off the job, they're just like, oh my God, now I have to go home. Like they're, yeah, they're more upset than the people who are going to work, you know? Like, it's, and also the, you know, autocrats and the all-encompassing power of people like Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, people who take and take and take and they give nothing back. This whole idea of like the dehumanization of machines not being a liberator, not being a helper of humanity, but are actually like dragging people down. And in the film, it's machines, robots, not AI or whatever is our current, you know, kind
or
of thing.
Or whatever it will be in 100 years.
Or what it'll be in 100 years. But it's still going to be relevant, all down to the, like, maybe even inadvertently relevant idea of a sheltered Nepo baby, like, mm-hmm, overcoming his guilt by rebranding as a self-styled revolutionary leader who is the only person who can save us, right? Like, I mean, some of that stuff is just, like, it doesn't really, it's relevant, but maybe like the argument isn't as relevant. But at the same time, like, my God, it's so powerful. It's such a powerful, powerful, yeah, experience of a movie. And like the epic scenes, everything is just designed to blow your fucking mind. You know what I mean? Like, every shot, every scene, every idea. And it's not just like special effects or sets and stuff, although those are absolutely amazing, but like the carpets, like, yeah, are amazing. The staircases, things like that, like the acting, again, everything that is designed to the hilt. Everything that is acted to the hilt. It's just unbelievable that anyone would ever like take this and say like, I should just rip this to shreds. I mean, that tells you so much about like fascists and the kind of censors and the kind of like their fucked up values, right? That they don't value art, they value like, you know, control and things like that.
The sheer size and scope of sets,
mm-hmm,
what they're doing and filling the scenery with, the choreography.
Mm.
Yeah. Of some of the movements of the workers,
things. Yeah.
Showing them downtrodden, walking, showing them working. My favorite shot is of that big machine that they're all working on, and they're all hitting these dials at the same time.
Yeah,
and it's different herky-jerky movements, but it's all coordinated at once. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like the man and machine are just like fused as one. Like, the man is just like, his humanity is totally subservient to whatever the machine needs him to do.
It's better that you don't know. Like, they don't take pains to explain what these machines even do. Mm-hmm. It's just like, that doesn't matter. Just humans feed the machines, and that's what you do.
Right. But if they don't do it, like, the machine explodes. And like, it's the workers who are going to like suffer the consequences of that. Yeah. My best comp for this movie of all of the films that we've done so far would be Playtime.
Yeah.
I've thought about that one. I've mentioned it already. But it's just, again, it's just like, everything in Playtime is just so thought out. Everything is just so perfectly choreographed, as you said, so brilliantly realized and executed on the scale that the filmmaker wanted, with all of the kind of like ideas and concepts that the filmmaker wanted. I mean, it's just like, it's a vision. It's true. It's an epic vision, like genuinely realized. And let's like, yeah, that happens so, so fucking rarely.
You and know, Playtime, Playtime similarly is almost a silent movie. It's because dialogue doesn't help that movie propel, but you don't have any problem with understanding motivation and getting every single thing that's happening. It's a visual feast.
Yeah. Oh, my. Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the plot, if we want to talk about it. The movie's divided into these three parts, which, again, it gives it this... a totally, like, when people were kind of messing with the score... I don't want to say messing with. They were creating their own scores because the score didn't exist, right?
And I will say, don't watch the Tubi version, everybody. That is like a...
Oh, boy.
It's crazy. I got 20 seconds in. I was like, no, wait. I can't fucking do this.
That's not right. That's not right. Again, I mean, it's... yeah, there's all these different versions that are floating around. But a lot of the people who would create a score for the film... they would do an electronic score or like an experimental score, kind of playing on the futuristic themes of the film. The score that was created has much more of like a John Williams sort of a feel to it. Like, it's an epic, sweeping sort of a score. And it really kind of fits what the movie is when you put it all back together again, which is this like epic scope of like going from the top, going all the way to the bottom, and then somehow meeting like there in the middle at the end. But it's divided into these three parts of the story: Prelude, Intermezzo, and Furioso. So kind of underlining that it's like a film of movements, you know, it's a film of these different kind of parts. And basically, so it's Metropolis. Metropolis is just this giant city, which we see in a few just, I mean, this is like some of the most famous shots of the film.
How?
The stunning model of it. Yeah. It's part model, it's part special effects, it's part, I mean, some of these are unbelievable, you know, and this gigantic city ruled by the new Tower of Babel. It's somewhat ironic because like, there's just one guy up at the Tower of Babel, and he rules over everybody, and you speak his language or you get the fuck out, right? So it's not quite like the whole original kind of thing there. But yeah, so that's Joe Frederson, is the master of Metropolis, right?
He's built and the whole fucking place.
He's the whole thing, and he rules over it, and he sees all, and he knows all, and he has no compassion whatsoever for the people below, right? Only a slight bit of compassion for his spoiled son, Freighter, who is, I guess, sort of like the star of the film, I guess you could say, right? Like, he's sort of our hero. Freighter plays in the Club of the Suns, you know? So, again, this whole, like, nepotism thing, this whole inherited wealth thing. Again, this is as relevant as ever. And then he frolics in the Eternal Gardens, which is just basically a harem of them, right? Like, so it's like, this, you know, again, this kid is like born on third base, acting like he just did a stand-up triple. He's beating everybody in races. He's, of course, betting these women in the gardens because they're hired to be betted by him. And then he meets Maria. Maria just pops in.
Yeah, just wanders into an elevator one day
with some urchins, and is just like, check this out. You know, this is how your brothers live. You know, kind of.
If you haven't seen this movie, anything we say, like she wanders in, she's in an elevator. Okay, times it by 17,000 times the size and scope of what you're imagining.
Right.
It's not a
like
room.
You think, oh, there's an elevator right now. Yeah. No. Yeah, right.
This
you
is like an entire room.
100 people on this elevator, and later they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything is, it's Metropolis, right? Everything is large. Everything is outsized. Everything is enormous. Everything is like looming and crazy. I mean, again, these shots of the whole city with these highways in the sky, with planes
I don't know how
flying
they do it.
Through the city, and cars and trains. And there's, again, like, in any shot, like the choreography of background action is fantastic as well. And you're thinking, like, were walkie-talkies even invented at this time? Like, how did you even do all this stuff? It just makes
And the thing sense. Is, it's not like these big highways and cities existed mm-hmm. at this time. This is just imagining, and it still gets it fucking right with like that traffic is going on in the background while shit is happening in the foreground. Mm-hmm. That's how busy and bustling this city is. There's a part near the end where Josephus is walking on that highway where the cars are all parked. Cause I'm like, oh, that's a really cool model. That's a model. Holy fuck. There's someone walking on it. That's not a model. They built this whole goddamn thing.
Well, they also were using special effects where you could shoot someone and make it seem as though they were interacting in the model. So there was a groundbreaking.
The fact that it's 100 years ago
and it's seamless.
I can't figure it out. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's just it. It's absolutely seamless. And I think what's also impressive about this movie in particular, as we said, like it's cobbled together from all these different prints. The image quality varies widely throughout the film. There's a lot of it, like 2/3 of it, I'd say, is like crisp, immaculate, crystal clear, HD level imagery. And then there's a lot of stuff that is like the restored things that are blurry, they're heavily scratched, or they're otherwise damaged, light damaged or something like that. Some scenes are missing altogether and they're replaced with a description of what happens in the scene. What's surprising again is that it's all seamless. Like it has this like energy that just keeps going, which I think is a testament obviously to Lang and his team, but it's also to the archiving and restoration teams who made this print. Because if you think like it was 153 minutes when it premiered, now it's at 148 minutes, right? So obviously there's editing that needed to be done. There's also editing that needed to be done with the score, which was written for a 153-minute film. Like there's these things that are happening behind the scenes to make it this seamless experience. But like it's never like, oh, wow, it stops here and I'm hearing a description and I'm not getting the momentum's lost in the film, or I'm lost in the story, or I'm taken out of it somehow. Not taken out of it at all. I mean, it's just like the propulsive like energy of this film just like keeps going and going and going from moment one right until the very end of the movie.
So he meets Maria. She comes with children that are ragamuffin, barefoot, up into this garden of the eternally privileged. And he instantly falls for her, and his whole mission now is to whatever Maria wants, Maria gets.
Right? Yeah. How do you solve a problem like Maria is what he's basically saying. Mariah. and he's captivated with her. She's quite beautiful, right? We see her in these amazing close-ups, and she's just stunningly beautiful woman. And, you know, he's a young man. He's skirt chasing up in the Eternal Gardens. And it's also the classic, like, I am a guy who can get any woman I want, and this woman is unattainable to me. And so at first it seems like he's skirt chasing, right? He's just checking out the cute girl and like, what's her whole deal, right? I don't know what's her whole deal. So he follows her down below and for the first time really ever in his life sees what it is like for the people who are working in these factories and who are maintaining the machines, and finally realizes that like everything I have, this lofty position I have, is only there because I'm standing on the backs of all of these people, of millions and millions and millions of people. And it's the guilt of it like tears them apart. What's great though is that like it's could be very polemical. That could be very like a lot of, you know, I mean, it's a silent movie, but still it could get very preachy. Instead, it preaches to you through the horror of the visuals, right? Like it's the striking visuals of it that like make it so powerful. You could just say like, oh my God, conditions are bad. Look at that. But him actually seeing this machine transform into Moloch, the Canaanite god, and just like shoving like slaves into the maw, and, you know, just to feed the beast, feed the fire. Like, that's so much more powerful than any kind of speech or anything like that. And it's horrifying. Like, it really is like some fucked up shit that is going on. And again, it's just perfectly choreographed with like marching, march, 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 march into the fire, into the fire, into the fire, you know. So it's a it's really, really, really powerful filmmaking here. It's one of my favorite sequences in the film is him coming down and just seeing how horrible it is. Like, this accident happens. I mean, he just sees like, oh my God, like, you can't believe that these people are just like part of this machine. So anyway, this changes everything, but it changes even more when he goes upstairs to tell Dad, and Dad could not care less. Dad's actually fires the guy, who his assistant, who didn't tell him about this stuff. And at this point, of course, Frater realizes that, you know, being fired from up above means going down below, and he knows exactly how horrible that is, right? So again, it's this is what kind of the turning point for him is, not just seeing it, but going to Dad, reporting it, and Dad literally shrugging.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is like, this is the lie that the wealthy and the powerful have to tell themselves, which is that I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. They're supposed to be there. Shrug if something goes wrong, right? So, you know, so Dad is embodying that kind of attitude. But Frater says, no go, Papa-san. Yeah, I know. Does a little Prince and the Pauper thing.
You go enjoy a night on the town at this hangout.
What I love,
I'm going to go work your shift and almost die because I have to work an 8-hour shift.
Yeah. This, I think, is something that's left almost... This is an example of something that's almost left totally out of all of the versions that have come before, which is the fate of Georgie 11811. Again, like, he's a number, really, more than anything, right? So, yeah, he says, here, I'm going to replace you on your shift. I'll you take my clothes, I'll take your clothes. I'm going to kind of infiltrate and kind of get this feeling for it. So he kind of takes his part on the machine, and he says, go back, go to this place, meet up with Josephat, who is the assistant who was fired, and wait for me there, and then, you know, we'll make all this happen, right? So that dude immediately is like, oh, shit, there's a lot of money in these clothes, because this is a rich dude. Someone throws in a flyer for a club, and immediately he's like, hit me over to the club, right?
Yeah.
Like, forget about all that, which I just think is like... Again, anything you can keep it away from being a one-sided polemic is always interesting to me. And here, right away, you're just like, this guy like feels no loyalty towards this cause, towards his fellow man, towards anything else, right? This is what the machine fucking does to you. Like, it so divorces you of your humanity that the second you have a chance to just go out and, you know, spend that money, have a blast, get wasted and party, you're going to do it. You know what I mean? So it's, again, there's a whole religious undertone to this thing. The whole thing about the seven deadly sins.
Yeah.
Vision of the apocalypse, the woman riding
Tower of Babel,
the Hydra, and the Tower of Babel, the new Tower of Babel versus the old Tower of Babel. Boy, there's a lot going on here. And then, of course, the whole use of doppelgangers.
Mm.
Because eventually we meet Rotwang, the inventor, the mad scientist, right? Rotwang is building a machine man, which is actually in the persona of Hell, who is... So this is all very complicated, but she's Joe, the master of the city. She's Joe's ex-wife. She died giving birth to Frater. But Rotwang was always in love with her, and he's actually built a shrine to her and has now built a robot to kind of recreated her as a robot. And in this, Joe sees an opportunity to undermine Maria, the real Maria, who is rallying the workers, but rallying the workers to not riot. Because he's such a swell feller. Joe wants them to riot, of course, because he wants any excuse to use overwhelming force and absolutely crush them forever. So he has him build this Maria lookalike to replace her. And there's this whole thing of doppelgangers. And so the good Maria, who again is like this inspiration, this like the mother of the workers, you know, she's this really inspiring figure. They go down to the catacombs to listen to her speak. But she's speaking a piece. She's giving the head, hand, heart, you know, speech, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. When they create the other Maria, she is in league with Satan, apparently, right?
Yeah.
And she's giving the speech of, like, you know, burn it all the fuck down. And what I think is really fascinating, again, the politics are often quite simple and simplistic, but they're both making a pretty compelling case, I think. And they're like working against each other. And you're like, well, yeah, on the one hand, empathy, generosity, brotherhood, those are good things. And, you know, a little bit more of that and the world wouldn't be such a horrible nightmare. But on the other hand, we've seen how soul crushing this system is. It's not like you're this close to bringing it all together, right? Like it's just so horrible. Burn the whole fucking thing to the ground. Like, what good is any of it? You're like, yeah, well, you know, evil robot Maria is actually making a pretty solid case.
And I gotta say again, this performance from Brigitte Helm as the two Marias.
Well, it's the three, really, because she also is inside the machine costume as well. Yeah.
That's crazy that they made her get in the costume. Yeah, I mean, it's like they can't have somebody else do that.
But she's so beatific as good Maria, and then she is just so, like, sinister.
It's this physical change that she undertakes. It's like really her amazing. Eyes
and her body and everything.
Contortions. Yeah. She's almost moving like Klaus Kinski in Inigiri,
the
way she moves. But there's these through lines in both characters, like the clutching of her breast. She does it as both sweet Maria and evil Maria. Like, there's these through lines, and it's such an amazing thing to watch, like, an 18-year-old first-time film star do. And you understand that she shot this over, like, 2 years of her life. It's fucking crazy. So good.
Oh, yeah. And you also, the stories about the production, how difficult it was and what a taskmaster Fritz Lang was and all these scenes. I mean, because you see, when they are storming the machine, the heart machine at the end, you can see people's breath.
Yeah, it was freezing,
right? There is a whole scene where everybody is like waist deep in water. Apparently, they just shot that for weeks.
Good
Lord.
All
these kind of things, you know. And it's just like everyone was getting, you know, pneumonia and shit like that. It was a grueling shoot, physically demanding shoot. But yeah, she's absolutely stunning. A lot of the, you know, you can see it and say like, okay, well, this is silent movie sort of acting. But yeah, what she's doing is pretty fantastic stuff. And she's doing it on multiple levels because, again, she's so good as both of the Marias.
And the intermezzo part plays with a lot of this. She's whipping up the workers. The workers are getting crazed and they're not thinking straight. But fuck it. They want freedom. They know what that's like. Mm-hmm. The evil dad is like, yeah, let them do what they want. We'll crush them. He knows he has to keep everybody down. And his son is just spiraling. Like, he's kind of too weak for any real fight, but he wants to be involved. And I got to say, the Furiosa climax, I'll put this third act of this movie up against any movie of the past 100 years. Like, this movie is 100 years old, but it is as compelling and building and racing towards an end as any movie you could name that is a masterpiece that you've seen. It is stunning how good it is.
Yeah, it's epic. Truly epic stuff. All I said, all the flooding scenes down below, all tearing apart the machinery, the people going up the elevators and exhorting everybody else to join them, all these amazing like riot scenes, the scenes of them dancing around the wrecked machinery hand in hand, doing like some sort of a Midsommar style fucking cult dance like around like the machines. Yeah, it's bonkers. And I think culminating in like this amazing sequence where there's the two crowds, right? Like there's the oppressed workers who are tearing it all apart. And then Maria, the evil Maria, is also leading like all the elites down to get to look at it, to say, and they crash.
Just watch the city fall
into each other. They just crash. Like both Marias almost crash right into each other. And they actually, like, as they're chasing the wrong Maria, the crowd somehow grabs the right Maria. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many like things that are happening that are not like moral decisions. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like it's mistaken identity, you know, and it just becomes a moral decision. And that's what I think is so great about this film, that even though like outwardly it's the politics can seem a little simple, I do think there's a lot of complexity going on in all of the like things just crashing into each other and smashing into each other and butting up against each other and contradicting each other and the crowd going after the wrong person and finding the right person somehow. And they go after Freighter, and they remember they stab 11811.
Georgie, R.I.P.
11811 is like realize that he feels bad for it because he's like kind of part of the reason this has all gone, you know, tits up. And he actually runs in to save Freighter at the last minute. He's about to be stabbed. He gets stabbed instead and dies. That's what incites the crowd to like, really, like, let's fucking burn this mother down. Yeah, that's like, again, they're making a decision based on wrong information. You know,
there's a part. There's a part in the intermezzo part where Freighter is trying to save Maria from Ratwing, and he can't get through the doors on time. And the pacing is that of Beyond the Seventh Door, like that movie we watched on Dear Daniel, where you're just having to watch a guy kill 2 minutes, like can't get through a door. So that gone by the end. You want to talk about moral decisions? The workers are so whipped up in a frenzy they fucking forget their kids. They're running to destroy and flood the city, and it's like, oh yeah, our kids are down in the catacombs still. Maria and what's his name again? Jaira. Freighter. They're the ones who save all the children. And as uncompelling as him not being able to get through the door was, it's so compelling just watching these hundreds of children soaked to the bone in rags and these two climbing stairs. It's just stair after stair, and they are packed. The scope and the realness of what they're doing is, it's so amazing.
It actually made me think of another film I caught up with for award season recently, which is Weapons, the Zach Kreger film. Because in there is this whole kind of theme about parents caring more about scapegoating and revenge than about the actual welfare of their children, which gets kind of almost completely forgotten in that. And that this sequence made me think of that too, because again,
sure,
they just run off to like smash everything to bits. They then smash everything to bits, which leads to a flood, which will kill all of their children. Yeah. They're like, oh shit, let's go smash some more, right? Like now we need more revenge. Like now, like there's a different revenge that we need now, right? Like
there's also a great turn.
These things, yeah.
There's a great turn where the one worker who's standing up to the other one saying, look, listen, you guys, you're being crazy. Your children are going to die. What are you doing? By the end, he's like, okay, they all did this, but it's your fault. And he's like now not with them in the frenzy, but with them in like, you guys got to pay for this.
Yeah.
And he's the one leading them against Maria and Freighter.
Exactly. Yes. You know, he immediately it turns on to, well, now I need someone to blame too, right? So yeah. Like, who do we move on to? And that, again, at no point are they like, should we go check and make sure their children aren't drowned? No. Let's get back into the whole retribution thing. Yeah. So it did make me think of Weapons, which was kind of funny.
So Metropolis go Gonicus. It goes bye-bye. It gets shut down. It goes dark. They flood it. They destroy it. We never get a resolution on the dad, but we see him mournfully looking out the window or maybe contemplating the error of his ways. Ratwing dies and Freighter and Maria embrace.
Yeah, well, wow, did you watch a different version than me?
Maybe.
Dad, Joe? No, Joe. What? I have to figure out what version you watched. But yeah, in the fully restored version, is the bringing together of the.
No, you're right. Shit, the heart and the hand.
Yes, the heart.
That is okay. That's a really good part because they don't go. It's like, okay, well, here's the, you know, denouement. They're going to meet and they're going to come together and realize everything should be together. Mm-hmm. They don't. They reject each other. And
yeah,
the mediator has to solve it.
Exactly. And the mediator, of course, is not Maria somehow, but Frater. Now, which, you know, works within the, you know, the film within its own kind of the box that the film's created. But just as a heads up to any labor unions, organizers out there, the mediator should not be the boss's son. That is a bad mediator, okay? Like, the mediator, as a rule, should not have a financial stake in the negotiations. That's what makes them a mediator, just as a heads up. But with here within the film, it works. Yes, who'd have thought a rich person with a heart? And, you know, they bring the head and the hands together, you know, which all good. And everybody's doing all right, at least in a symbolic sense. I don't know what it means for the people of Metropolis, which obviously there's, you know, tens of millions of them. And there's only a few hundred people in this room, but, you know, sure, it'll all work out. But yeah, symbolically, head and hand have come together. But again, within the confines of the movie, this has all been this like big building the whole time, right? Like, again, that first part, the prelude, is setting the stage. Here's the world. Here's the conflict. Here's the rich guy realizing what's going on and, you know, bringing intermezzo is, you know, kind of flipping it around and lots of, you know, subterfuge and mistaken identities and kidnappings and things like that. And then Furioso, it's all coming to a head. Like, it's all been building and building and building. And then Furioso is just, it lives up to its name. You know, it is, it's powerful, epic, angry, very exciting filmmaking. And then it kind of comes down into somewhat of a pat place of the, you know, the mediator between the head and the hands must be the heart. You know, I don't even think Fritz Lang necessarily believed that. But as a little ribbon to tie up this powerful dystopic sci-fi vision, and it's truly a vision, I think it works okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Corky, before we wrap this up, any scene, sequence, shot that stood out for you that we didn't get to talk about?
It's hard to choose, man. There's so much.
You can't even.
It's got to be the parts that are the most well known, where she's changing into the machine man.
The transformation scene is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And is the template for any transformation scene. Any kind of like evil scientist type scene. Even, you know, the classic Frankenstein, but also Del Toro's Frankenstein, all the way up to that.
Yeah. Too many to name.
Yeah. There's one that I agree. I agree. If I'm just going to pluck one out of the blue that just popped into my head, it's the sequence where evil Mariah has come out. And she's not only sowing like discourse below the surface, she's actually sowing discourse above the surface too.
Yeah.
She's acting as this like Jezebel figure and just turning all of the men violent. They all want her, right?
Yeah.
And so they're all like, you know, they will duel with each other. They'll just murder each other right in front of her. But it starts off with this sequence where it's just like the shot of like eyes. Earth is like eyes. Like you see eyes and you see faces, but then you just see eyes. And it's all done with like an optical printer or some kind of special effects like that. And there's like 10 or 12 disembodied eyes along with like faces and things like that. So this is the thing of like, yes, there are these amazing sets and visual effects and things like that. But there's also just like a bold artistic vision like of cinema and all the possibilities that you can do with editing and with montage. And this is one of those sequences, just eyes. I mean, and it's so creepy, but it's also so fucking good. All right. Well, It's in the bag, but, you know, there's some boilerplate here. We got to wrap this up just to make this official. Of Quirky, of course, we rate films on the slight or sound system. If we both think it was a sound selection, then kaboom, into the cannon fodder canon it goes. If one or both of us think it was a little slight, no cannon fodder canon for you, no boom, and we'll pick a slighted movie not in the top 250 to put in its place. But Quirky, Metropolis.
Oh, kablammo, baby. This
right?
is
for a silent film. This makes a big, big sound.
Hark, I hear the cannons roar.
Easy decision.
I don't say it a lot because I don't believe it. And it's crazy to say it about a movie that was butchered and torn apart and pieces cribbed together from long dormant places across the earth. But this is a perfect movie.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That the story of this movie results in such a perfect movie. But man, when you see it, you just got to recognize how great it is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a shame that we'll probably never really see the fully realized version, because again, there's still like 5 minutes missing, and there's still generous chunks of this movie that are, you know, just really poor, grainy.
Looks like it's shot through cheesecloth or something.
Yeah, it's just some of them just look really, really bad. Some of them look a little damaged. Some look very, very heavily damaged. God, I can only imagine how it must have been to see this film opening night in 1927 was just like, with a live score, that would have been like the film event of the century for sure. Yeah, again, easy decision. Metropolis. If you haven't seen it, by God, see it, and be sure to see it in the fully restored 148-minute version, which you can find on Canopy. You can get that through your local library, and I think it's also available for rent on VOD services. Physical media is also out there, you know, but I highly recommend seeing it. And we got two sound selections, and that means we got another entry into our canon.
All right, that's what we thought about Metropolis. Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on it. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram. Please, please let us know what you think.
All right, it is that time of the show, Quirky, where we're going to pick the film that we will be reviewing on our next episode. However, our next episode will not be in 2 weeks.
Uh-oh.
In 2 weeks, we'll have Best of Cannon Fodder 2025, where we'll talk about some of the favorite films that we reviewed on the show this past year. We're also going to catch up on some of our slighted selections that we didn't watch, and we'll make some canon decisions on those as well. So that's in 2 weeks. Week after that, I'll be here with my Best of 2025, all the best films released into theaters this year. And then 2 weeks after that, will be the film we'll review on our show. That'll be 5 weeks away. But we're building buzz early, Quirky. So here we go. Random number generators, hit us with your love. What do you got? You got a number, and that number corresponds to it. Oh, my God. Jesus, it's like I summoned it out of thin air. It's a Jean-Luc fucking Godard film. How did I do that?
Oh, no.
Like, whoa. That, what? God, you think they're just numbers, and you think it's just random, and yet...
Then Moloch shows up and pops you in the eye with a Jean-Luc Godard.
There I am. I'm in his belly, feeding the fire. The film we have is, pardon my pronunciation, Perrault le Fou.
Oh.
1965 film directed by Jean-Luc Godard. Stars Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Of course.
Who was the star of Breathless. Also has Anna Karina. Give you the letterbox synopsis. Perrault escapes his boring society and travels from Paris to the Mediterranean Sea with Marianne, a girl chased by hitmen from Algeria. They lead an unorthodox life, always on the run. Quirky, have you seen Perrault le Fou?
I have not, but I do love a good Poirot, so Agatha Christie movies are always good for me.
Right, yeah, this is...
that little Albert Belgian Finney. Is so fastidious.
Albert Finney at his best.
I gotta go David Suchet. Suchet is the Poirot of Poirots for me.
No, Ustinov?
No, and definitely not Malkovich. Malkovich's Poirot, that should have been a Dear Daniel movie.
What about Brana?
Oh, Brana's better than Malkovich. Ooh. I put Brana above Ustinov, who actually was Belgian, like the only actual Belgian to play him.
That's too bad none of them are actually in this movie. But we're going to review Perrault le Fou, the Jean-Luc Godard film. How can you watch this along with us, is what I hear you asking. Criterion Channel, of course. As always, we don't make any money off it. We give them money, and yet we still endorse it. But it's also available on VOD services like Fandango and Amazon and Apple TV and so on and so forth. So come back in 5 weeks and watch that with us.
Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com, find Support the Show in the menu, or look for the Donate button. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
I'm Daniel Barnes, first reminding you that 2 weeks from now, Best of Cannon Fodder 2025, Daniel's Best Films of 2025, the week after that, and then in 2 weeks. Of course, it's Hercule Poirot le Fou. I might just be confusing things. I'm also saying, save us a seat in the back row.